It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says many adults have trouble maintaining friendships and building new ones, and she'll share some advice and research.
First, Governor Walker signed several bills into law yesterday covering a wide range of issues, including penalties for drunk driving, regulation of how long foreclosed homes can stay vacant, and whether local municipalities have the power to issue local ID cards.
Joining us to recap these bills is WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a bill that increases penalties for drunk driving offenses in Wisconsin. What is the basic shape of that one?
So basically what this bill does is increases penalties for a variety of repeat offenders for drunken driving offenses. So the biggest change is that it makes a fourth drunken driving offense an automatic felony. Previously, that could be a misdemeanor if the offense was committed less than 5 years since the previous offense. So now that's automatically a felony, and it also increases the maximum prison sentence for fifth offenses and beyond. Pumping up those prison times from 3 years to 5 years for fifth and sixth sentences. Seventh, eighth, and ninth offenses are bumped from 5 years to 7.5 years.
And ideally, I'm looking at that four offense change that you talked about there, the fourth offense, people wouldn't get to that point. Does the new law do anything to affect the penalties for first, second, or third offenses?
It doesn't, Veronica. It's just going from fourth offenses and beyond, which is something that opponents to the bill have criticized.
Do we know anything about the price tag on these changes?
You know, the changes are actually expected to be quite expensive for the state. The Department of Corrections actually issued a fiscal estimate that they thought it would cost their department between $98 million and $129 million per year. And that's because, you know, these felony convictions and prison sentences obviously are being lifted. So that's more people in jail for longer amounts of time. Costs more money.
And Laurel, you mentioned critics. What kind of support did this have bipartisanship-wise?
Well, you know, it did pass on a bipartisan basis. People are saying that, you know, these increased penalties are going to be deterrents to people who, you know, might have a couple drinks and then think about getting in the car and driving somewhere. Governor Walker, when he signed the bill yesterday, had a family with him that lost a family member to a repeat drunken driving offender. And he said that, you know, the bill, he hopes that will save lives and prevent people from getting behind the wheel.
And Wisconsin is currently the only state in the country where a first OWI is a ticket and it's not a criminal charge. Did that question come up in the debate surrounding this bill at all?
You know, it did. But I think that, you know, the pushback on that was just that, you know, they're looking at these repeat offenders and trying to keep them from committing repeat offenses.
And we're going to move on to look at a bill that passed that had particularly strong impact in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And officials there were hoping there might be a veto on this particular bill. But It's someone that affects urban blight and so-called zombie homes. Tell us about what that bill is and what it does.
Yeah. So first off, for those who might not be familiar, zombie homes are abandoned foreclosed properties. And basically what this bill does is it gives lenders up to a year before they have to sell these zombie homes. The previous law that was actually enacted after a 2015 Supreme Court decision, a unanimous Supreme Court decision, said that those lenders had to sell a property within 5 weeks. And that 5 week period was actually called a redemption period, and it gave the owner of the property a chance to pay their mortgage. So this is substantially increasing the amount of time that a lender has to sell the property.
So basically, it sounds like this new bill overrules that Supreme Court decision or overwrites it.
It does.
And what do officials in Milwaukee have to say about this?
Well, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is very displeased with this new law. He says that it's going to lead to an increase in crime in Milwaukee because these zombie homes could foster criminal activity. He also says that, you know, when there are losses on properties, when lenders can't sell properties, they can walk away from them after a year. That's another part of the law. So basically the cost for tearing down that home, whatever decides, you know, what they decide to do with the home goes to the taxpayer. And he also said that, you know, the foreclosure crisis in Milwaukee has cost the city about $35 million over the past few years, and that there are about 300 zombie properties in the city of Milwaukee. So it's a pretty big problem that the city's facing right now. And he says this bill, this law, is just going to make it worse.
So, Laura, what was the thinking behind changing the time a lender can hang onto a property from 5 weeks to a year?
Sure. So the major proponents of this bill were the Wisconsin Bankers Association and the Wisconsin Mortgage Bankers Association. And they said that the law clarifies the process of, you know, how these properties need to be handled and gotten rid of. Basically, what they said was they had this 5 week window that they had to sell the house in, but it wasn't clear actually if the sale had to go through in that amount of time. So they said that this new 1 year period is a more solid parameter for them to work within.
So given, again, that this changed a Supreme Court decision, a state Supreme Court decision from 2015, do you think there could be a legal challenge in the works down the road?
That isn't something that I have heard about, but, you know, that could happen, I suppose. Yeah.
We're talking with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White right now, looking at some bills that were signed into law yesterday by Governor Walker. And the last one we're going to look at is one affecting photo identification cards and who can issue them. Tell us about this one.
Sure. So it was a very controversial bill moving throughout the legislative process. You may remember that there were a large number of protesters at the Capitol in February for this bill, as well as the Sanctuary Cities bill. Opponents to the bill, which is now a law, say that it's an anti-immigrant measure aimed at Milwaukee and the county that are looking at giving local ID cards to folks who can't get a state-issued driver's license or another government-issued ID card.
And what would those city or municipality issued IDs be used for, or what would they have before this bill?
Sure. So people wanted to, you know, the groups that wanted this, the undocumented immigrants, the transgender community, formerly incarcerated people, said that the ID cards could help them do things like get prescriptions or, you know, things where a photo ID is necessary when they can't get a state issued driver's license, things like that.
And what did critics say about that effort from municipalities and cities?
Well, you know, critics to that effort said that it was confusing, that state-issued ID cards are something that the state needs to handle, and so local governments really shouldn't be handling that type of thing, that created confusion for people. And they were also saying that, you know, local ID cards opened up the potential for fraud in voting or even in things like collecting food stamp benefits.
And when does this go into effect now that this is not an option on the table anymore?
I believe that it goes into effect this week.
And is that the case with everything we've talked about today?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that is the case.
And looking ahead, you know, this is the end of a legislative session. The governor has been signing bills. Are there more coming up that you're looking at?
Yes, the governor has been on quite the bill signing spree lately, which is to be expected now that the legislators have gone home for the year. Today he signed some bills on treatment and diversion programs, again, looking at drunken driving offenders, and also on some regulation on waterfront properties and requiring schools to provide CPR training to students. So he's out there, he's signing a lot of bills, and we're looking forward to a lot more to come.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
That was WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White giving us a rundown of bills that were signed into law by Governor Walker yesterday.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, one political writer tells us about the UW Extension's political history and what cutting its funding could mean for Wisconsin.
First, if you've ever noticed that it's harder to keep and make friends as you get older, it turns out you've got lots of company. We came across an article here at Central Time on adult friendships. Turns out, looking at research, people slowly lose touch with friends over the years. Many people, not everybody. But here's the deal. It gets harder to replace those friends, to build new friendships as we age.
And that's the bad news. But there may be things people can do to bring friendship back into their life, to make new friendships, even when you're not in high school or college together, when you're not the same age and seeing each other every day. And we want to hear what you have to say about this. What is your experience as an adult, a grown up, trying to make friends or keep friends.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Do you have fewer friends now than you used to? Why is that? Is it hard to make new friends, or maybe you've succeeded? What have you done to arrange, friend dates to meet new people and make new friends? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page, where we've got that article, by the way, that we were talking
about.
And
one interesting fact, when you partner up, it turns out you lose an average of 2 friends, which can explain maybe part of the loss of friends as we get older. So why is it a little bit harder, do you think? Call 800-642-1234. Does this sound like you? Is this your story that you look around and you go, where are all my friends? I used to have so many and now they're just not around as much. Let us know. 800-642-1234.
And is it hard to find out ways to make new friends? Here's a clip of Paul Rudd in the 2009 movie I Love You, Man. He doesn't have friends, so he's trying to figure out how to find some.
So what do? How do I meet friends?
If you see a cool-looking guy, strike up a conversation and ask him on a man date.
Okay, you know what I mean?
No.
Casual lunch or after-work drinks. You're not taking these boys to see The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, God, I love that movie.
So, yeah, it's different as an adult. You can't say, walk up to somebody and say, will you play with me? Will you be my friend? Or maybe you can. I don't know. We'll let our listeners tell us now.
I wish you could, don't you?
Well, you're better at that than I am. Anyway.
All right, let's take a caller and see what they have to say. Mark, you're first in Black Creek. Mark, hi.
Hi there. My wife and I, 3 years ago, moved to Black Creek from central Wisconsin. And, yeah, it's been almost impossible to make friends. I go to the YMCA to gymnastics with my kids, and everybody's on their cell phone or text messaging, and it's like I don't exist. Or we go to the park, and it's like I don't exist.
Mark, that's interesting. You sound like a nice guy. Yeah. So technology having an effect. Mark saying technology is getting in the way. People are on their cell phones. And this is something that happens with our friends, right? You're there with someone and they're on their phone.
Actual existing friends. But that's true. Like, because pre-phone day, you're looking to kill, unless you bring a book. And I always bring a book, so I'm not good at this. But pre-phone day, you'd be standing around with the other parents or whatever at the kids' class. And what are you going to do? You're going to talk to each other. And maybe, I don't know, maybe you like the other people.
Right. And so, Mark, one suggestion from the article that's up on our Facebook page is that you approach people, get to know them, and get phone numbers. Be a little more aggressive in the way you'd normally approach these social situations. So something to try. And then you set up, I guess, a couple friend dates.
Yeah. And maybe you approach it like, hey, we can maybe swap off carpooling with the kids. And then you've got the conversation starter. I don't know.
Right.
A couple strategies there, Mark. Good luck.
I say this like I've tried it before, but I have not. Good luck, Mark. Hope that works out for you. And we're going to go next to Carrie in Port Washington. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that when my kids were younger, I really had no problem finding friends because it was always the friends of my kids' friends. If they were hanging out, I always hung out with them. But when I hit, 45, I just felt like I had lost some of that, and I made a wild choice to get my motorcycle license, and by doing so I ran into a few people who invited me to come to a meeting, and now I'm a member of Stilettos on Steel, which is a nationwide organization but started in Milwaukee or in the Wisconsin area, and there's like 400 members now, and it's a great thing. We ride when we want together. You don't have to go on every ride, but you're always meeting new people, and a different kind of camaraderie of people from all different backgrounds.
And I want to ask, Carrie, do you sometimes do non-motorcycle related activities? Have met friends that you have non-motorcycle themed brunch or something with?
Well, we do things during the winter, obviously, to keep in touch. So we do like these painting and wine parties or bowling. But they do have something like almost every week, so that if you want to stay in touch, there's plenty of opportunity.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a great idea. Thank you so much for sharing that, Carrie. And I think that is a good bit of general advice. Find an activity you like, a fun activity that isn't playing solitaire at home or binge watching TV shows, something that involves being out with other people.
Right. Common interests. And there's your ready-made friend group.
And a conversation starter.
And we'll go back to our phones. Keith is next at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. As we talk about why it's harder to make friends when you're a grown-up, when you're an adult. 800-642-1234. And Keith from Green Bay, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm in a situation where my wife died 3 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it's as if, to a lot of people, I died too. A lot of the couples that we were friends don't remember me anymore or haven't remembered me in the last 3 years. So I've had to make a great effort to develop new interests. But even so, it's difficult to make friends when you are a single person dealing, especially in my age group. I'm in my early 60s. Where there are couples or there are single women, but not a lot of single men.
Oh, interesting, but, interesting story, Keith. And have you tried following up and being back in touch regularly with some of those older people to remind them, hey, I'm still around?
I think it's awkward for them because I'm kind of the extra wheel. And there have been a couple of instances where it wasn't as comfortable as it was. I think it's kind of painful for them to know, you know, to remember that I used to be part of a couple and now I'm not anymore and she's gone.
I appreciate you sharing that, Keith.
Yeah, that's a tough story. I imagine there are support groups in that age range, I would bet, probably even specifically for men or maybe for men and women who have lost a partner. I also know someone I know in town lost their partner and kind of met other people who had lost their partners. Now they actually have moved in near each other, not with each other, but near each other. And they're kind of like a semi-intentional community of people who are that, you know, they're the plus one. They're the date for each other a lot of the time.
Right. And this gets at some of the aspects about it. A lot of the time, I guess, being harder for men than women because men apparently are less likely to reach out. So,
well, I am. Yeah, no, definitely. So good luck to you, Keith. And keep us posted. I hope you find some a support group, a local community there. We'll go next to Steve with us in Medford. Steve, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling, you know, my wife and I, we moved to a smaller town. And, you know, at first it's hard to meet new people. But since we've had kids, it seems like it helps a lot. And, you know, you meet other people that have kids the same age.
And do they, I mean, are they just, you know, oh, they're other parents, you know, or have you become friends with some of those other parents in your community?
Yeah. You just, you know, I don't know if it's easier just because, you know, you say, well, you know, our kids want to hang out. Well, really, you want to hang out with the other person or what? But it definitely seems to be a common interest, you know.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And yeah, it's easier to say, hey, let's arrange a play date for our kids than, hey, fellow adult, let's arrange a play date. It feels weird, but that's what this article's recommending.
Right. It shouldn't. It makes me wonder if getting a dog would serve the same function as a kid, because most of us, at a certain point of life, we can't have a kid anymore. It's not in the cars, but we could get a dog
and walk
a dog, and maybe that would be kind of a proxy kid.
Buddies at the dog park, definitely.
Right.
Dog walking dates. Play date for the dogs. Yes, that's true. I think you're onto something here, Veronica.
All right, thanks a lot for that. And then we're going to go to David in La Crosse. David, hi.
Yeah. I got divorced recently and moved into La Crosse. And I go to work and I come home. That's about it. I don't go anywhere. I don't go to bars no more. I don't go to church. I should, but I work Sundays. And I'm afraid to go to church because I'd be going for the wrong reasons. I don't want to use church as an eHarmony hookup.
There are, David, some new friend matchup sites, some apps for phones that I've heard about.
Really?
I have read about them. I've not tried them. I've been curious. It makes me think that there is a market for this kind of thing. But maybe, David, looking at the common interest angle that we've heard a little about today on the show. Maybe that's one way to go.
Definitely. And good luck to you, David. We're asking you to call in with your thoughts on adult friendship. Do you have fewer friends as you get older? Is it harder to make new friends? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Mark is with us next in Algoma. Mark, hi.
Hello. The situation my wife and I were in, once our kids all left home, we basically had the same experience as your other caller did, but we joined a local fraternal organization. We joined the Eagles, and, you know, there's lots of them out there, whether it's an Eagles or an Elks or any of them, and you can do it as a single or a couple, and you can get involved in fundraising for other charities, or they have bowling teams. It's a very good way to get involved with other people. and you do it at your own pace.
And Mark, I mean, you're connected to your community, you meet the people there, and have you ended up with friends you hang out outside of the Eagles meetings?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and whether it's playing cards or your other caller, the gal there, she was involved in a motorcycle group. My wife and I rode motorcycles for several years. But there's just all kinds of things to do with. And, you know, the fraternal organizations, they kind of lost favor in the last 30 years or so, but they're still great places to mingle and to go out and interact with other people.
Fantastic, Mark. Thank you so much, and thanks for all your calls. Well, this struck a chord with people.
Definitely, right. So check out that article up on the Central Time Facebook page. Some ideas and advice there for getting started. And, yeah, it's a tough thing, obviously, that everyone, you and I have experienced it. Just about everyone has, I think, as you get older. It's just not as easy.
Yeah, you can keep sharing your stories about adult friendships, the successes, what you've tried, what works, what didn't. That's at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, a political writer tells us about the history of UW Extension and why he believes cutting its funding is a blow to Wisconsin's identity. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Emergency responders in Madison say they've seen a 300% increase in how many times they've had to administer Narcan from January to March. Narcan's a medication given to revive someone experiencing a heroin overdose. Officials say they've already given Narcan 61 times this month, compared to only 14 times last April.
One group working to address the heroin epidemic is the CARE program in Sauk City and Prairie du Sac. Dr. John McCullough joins us now to explain what the CARE program is. He's medical director of Sauk Prairie Health Systems, a family practice doctor, and the medical coordinator for the CARE program. Dr. McCullough, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us, what is the CARE program?
The CARE program really stands for Community Activated Recovery Enhancement, and it's a way to address the heroin issue within our community and taking sort of a community approach to that whole issue.
And how do patients find you, or how does the CARE program find patients? How is that connection made?
Yeah, well, basically, people enter the program three different ways. Number one, through the jail. Basically, if they've been incarcerated because of an opiate issue, they then can, upon being released from the jail, perhaps get through BadgerCare, get the Vivitrol shot, and that's their form of entry. They also can enter through the drug court that we have established within the past month or so within our community. And then they can self-refer, and we have several patients that have done it that way.
And you mentioned that Vivitrol shot, and I wanted to ask you about that. That seems like a key part of the program. What is this medication, Vivitrol?
Yeah, it's definitely a key part of it, and it sort of goes back to the notion of, or the idea that really addiction is a disease, and this is a medicine basically that gets control of the addiction part of it. It helps the craving, reduce the craving part, and so that is essentially the first thing that we really need to do, is to get a person that the addiction part under control. And the naltrexone, that's also the Vivitrol, is a way for us to do that. And once we get that part of it under control, then we start to do the wraparound program, the psychosocial stuff, to get that also in order.
I think people might be familiar with something like methadone, which I understand it is a different kind of opioid to act as a replacement. This is a completely different approach, this Vivitrol, right?
This is an approach that's totally opiate-free. In other words, you probably have heard of methadone and Suboxone, but this is without any opiates. You know, the disease, again, that we're talking about is opiate addiction, and so this enables us really to get rid of the opiates completely. As a matter of fact, before we can get a person on naltrexone, we have to withdraw them. And that's where the jail has been actually some benefit to that whole issue, is that while they're in the jail, we can withdraw them, and then we can get them on the naltrexone.
And this says... This says something about the nature of opioid addictions, doesn't it? I think people looking in from the outside might say, well, these are weak-willed people. They don't have the willpower to kick the heroin, the opioids. It's just not that easy, is it, to do it without some kind of help?
That's a critical, critical distinction to make. When they have choices, granted, all of our brains are sort of wired when we, first experiment with drugs and stuff, that matter, there is a choice. But once the disease of addiction sets in, the choice is gone. It's really, I use the metaphor, if you were to take a breath in and let it out and take another breath in and let it out and take a third breath in and let it out, and now don't breathe. My telling you not to breathe is like my telling you not to use heroin. You are going to go there. I guarantee it. And that's where the naltrexone blocks that. And so people can take that breath. They can start to get their life back together. And it's really been really amazing to watch these people really transform once they get on the naltrexone and once they get other things, get their life back together.
What is the cost of this naltrexone or Vivitrol, and how does it compare to the costs of addiction going untreated?
Oh, I mean, the cost to society for addiction untreated, we can't even begin to know the true cost of all that. But just for instance, and this is one aspect of it. You know, our jails, like in Sauk County, 60% of the people who are in jail are there for opiate reasons. They've broken the law for that reason. It takes $35,000 to maintain a person in jail for 1 year, and that alone, and then a habit. If you're addicted, to maintain a habit every day is $100 to $200 a day. Well, these people aren't working, and so that has to come from someplace. And so, again, those costs just get amped up over time. The actual cost for the shot itself is about $1,200 a month, and we give the shot each month.
Money well spent, you'd say.
Oh, absolutely. There's just no comparison. I mean, that's... You know, when you talk, like I say, cost to society, let alone death, and you know, within the state just last year, we had 509 deaths. Within our county alone, we had 9 deaths and 69 saves from Narcan. I've heard about that, too. That's what we use right away if there is an overdose to save a life. And then we gradually, once we get them through withdrawal, get them on the naltrexone, the shot.
Talking to Dr. John McAuliffe, Medical Director of the Sauk Prairie Health Systems, talking about the CARE program aimed at ending addiction to opioids. You mentioned that the Vivitrol, the medication, is just part one. What happens next once somebody has withdrawn from opioids, used the Vivitrol? What else happens in the program?
And then what we do is we have an assessment to say if there are any other comorbidities. You know, is there bipolar issues? Are there mood disorders? Are there attention deficit issues, stuff of that nature, and address those issues at the same time that you have the addiction under control, because your ability really to deal with those issues is virtually nil if the addiction is still active. And so, again, that's where the naltrexone helps us do that. And, you know, the more I do this, the more I'm convinced the brain actually does want to get better, and these people actually do change from month to month to month, and it's very rewarding to see that. And the more I practice this, the more I am convinced that the naltrexone is to the addict as insulin is to the diabetic. You know, and the addict tells me that each and every day. They just say, with a naltrexone, I can function. Without it, it's difficult.
If somebody's on the naltrexone, is it something that they're going to be taking for the rest of their lives?
Right now, the program, there isn't a lot of data to say what we do after a year, but right now they sign up for a year of the program. And that seems to be about how long it takes for sort of the circuitry within our brain to sort of get reestablished. And that circuitry is, you know, how we make decisions, you know, what motivates us and all that. That's really hardwired. And that during addiction is lost. And so it appears to take about a year to get that back. But I think over time, though, we'll get more of a handle on just how long it actually they need to be on naltrexone.
But working with these patients so far, you're seeing, it sounds like, success stories that you wouldn't have seen before doing something like this.
You know, before 2 years ago, before I started doing this, I, you know, in all honesty, I really was not necessarily all that optimistic with what we were doing. But this has changed it. This is really, truly a game changer. And I see it consistently, and it's just not in, you know, one person this way, another person that way. It seems to really get them off on the right start.
You mentioned that the patients tend to come either from the jails or a drug court. Could somebody just self-refer, say,
yep,
hey, I'm an addict, I need help?
Yeah, about a third of our people are self-referred.
Now, you, this program started in Sauk Prairie, the Sauk City, Prairie du Sac area. Is it being replicated or expanded in other communities?
We do have a federal grant, actually, that is helping us do that. And so what we've done is we've set up a program where we divided the county in quadrants, and then we go out and actually, if there is an overdose or in the emergency room or something of some place, we go out and we have a resource person that goes out and contacts those people. And then if they need to go through withdrawal, we have a nurse that will help that withdrawal process. And then we have to do the prior authorization process to get the Vivitrol shot paid for. And then that's how they get started. And that then the... Once they're started on the Vivitrol, then, like I say, we can do the wraparound program, and that's where we have people that can actually do an assessment for these other comorbidities. And our goal is to develop a model that can be used in communities. And this year we're in Sauk. Next year we'll be going to Columbia County, and then the following year we're going to go to Richland County. So we're trying to create a model that can be propagated throughout the state. That's our goal.
This is an issue that people are talking about at every level. The state legislature has been working on this. Our attorney general in Wisconsin. We're also hearing, you know, the president and Congress, our
yep,
U.S. senators talking about this. Are you getting lots of visitors there, lots of attention, people hoping to find something that's going to turn the tide?
Absolutely. And you know, that points out a critical thing. I mean, we have to attack this problem from many different areas. I mean, in the medical society, we need to, you know, be doing certain things. We need to modify how we're treating chronic pain, for instance. And the CDC has recently come out with new guidelines suggesting how we do that. The state is very much involved, very supportive with the HOPE program up north, and is a similar program that's trying to address it. So It's being attacked from many different problems. And, of course, like any other disease, it still relies on prevention. And that's where we're doing it also, going into the schools and trying to do what we can to create a whole other awareness there. But I really think, you know, as the paradigm changes, it has to really sort of settle around the idea that this is a disease. And it's a disease, it's a chronic disease of the brain that affects the circuitry of the brain. And once you start to do that, you take the whole judgment part of it away, and then you can really start to be more effective in dealing with this whole problem. And that's, I think, is starting to happen within our society, and that's I think, going to be a very positive influence.
Dr. McAuliffe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. John McAuliffe, Medical Director of Sauk Prairie Health Systems, Family Practice Doctor, and Medical Coordinator for the CARE Program. He joins to talk about the CARE Program, an effort to help people break their addiction to heroin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, a multi-state panel reviewing Waukesha's application to divert its drinking water from Lake Michigan made steps toward a final agreement, but there's still a ways to go. Chuck Kornbach covered that meeting in Chicago for WPR News. He joins us now with the details. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Well, what happened at this meeting last week, Chuck?
Well, there were 2 days of meetings at the University of Illinois Chicago, just west of downtown, and the first day, Thursday afternoon, went long and was somewhat contentious. There were a lot of concerns raised, and it was certainly not a done deal ahead of time type of scenario. But then once the full panel halted around 7 o'clock, they broke into subcommittees or work groups to work on some key issues. By late that evening, there was a tentative plan, and that plan was more discussed more on Friday, about 3 more hours.
And Chuck, what was that plan?
Well, the key part of the plan seems to be a deal or a tentative deal to reduce the areas around the city of Waukesha that would get lake water. This has been a contentious issue for the last several months in this plan as to what neighboring communities, what neighborhoods, et cetera, would get lake water. The city, there's a this service area idea that the any area treated that serves as the wastewater treatment area also has to be provided drinking water, at least at Waukesha as the backup for some people on wells out there. But it now has come to a tentative agreement to trim the size of the water service area pending some additional details.
Chuck, as I understand it, all the participating states in the Great Lakes Compact have to ultimately sign off on this deal. Were they all represented? Were they all at the table at this meeting?
They were, and the most active representative was the state of Michigan, a fellow named Grant Trigger, who led quite often the discussion or at least commented on a lot of things, especially this water service area. The states of Minnesota was also active. The state of Illinois sounded more supportive of Waukesha, but there was input from just about everybody. Plus, let's not forget two provinces that get some weigh in on these recommendations, Quebec and Ontario, but they don't get final votes when the governors get around to acting, if they do in a couple of months.
And Chuck, I know that Waukesha's request had to be evaluated on several different points. Did it meet all the points?
Well, what is going to happen next, I believe, is the city of Waukesha and the Wisconsin DNR. The Wisconsin DNR has not quite said we like this proposal, but it meets the requirements of the Water Diversion Compact, and the DNR has basically had Waukesha's back, shall we say. They're going to come back to the panel, with, at least via conference call to begin with some additional details about how this service area might be restricted, maps and other details that we're expecting to be ready by a conference call that the panel is going to have around May 2nd. And then it goes to more additional public meetings, in-person meetings in Chicago, May 10th and 11th, I think they've set the dates.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach about the Great Lakes Water Compact and an effort by Waukesha to tap into Lake Michigan water. A meeting last night, Waukesha made the case moving closer to agreement with the states on their plan to divert water. Chuck, big picture, let's back up a little bit. What is at stake here for Waukesha? Why do they need to tap in, or why are they making the case that they need to tap into Lake Michigan water?
Sure, they've got radium contamination problems in the well water that serves Waukesha. There's also some thought that the water table is declining, although that's not consistent. But they're worried that they're not going to be able to come up with a reliable supply of drinking water, especially as the community grows. And they think, despite the fact it would cost many millions of dollars, that piping in lake water from Lake Michigan, using it, treating it, and piping it back on sort of a parallel path back for much of the way and into the river that would then flow through Racine is the best way to go. Futuristic as all that sounds and as expensive, that's what Waukesha is saying is the best way to go. And they're, of course, the first community just outside the Great Lakes Basin, but in a straddling county, a county that straddles the basin, Waukesha County, to make this application to the Great Lakes states, and it's somewhat of a landmark plan. In fact, some of the discussion last week was, well, what sort of precedent are we setting here if we agree? Would there be conditions peculiar to this situation that would not apply to later applications, or would this, how much of this would be sort of setting the tone?
And how did they answer that question about how big a precedent Waukesha could be as far as a tipping point?
Well, I think that's subject to further discussion. I mean, it seemed like by Friday midday, they had done what they call wordsmithing. They sat there as a committee, and as you can imagine, going through page by page, line by line of this, and it seemed like they had made a lot of progress, and some of us who thought, well, this isn't going to happen, started thinking, well, maybe this is going to happen. But again, it's not clear that it will because of details of this water service area. I think there's going to be more discussion about have the states really looked at alternatives for Waukesha and setting what sort of precedent. There's been a push by Michigan to say to Wisconsin, well, listen, if we agree to this, what about are there high capacity wells in southeastern Wisconsin? Are you going to let more of those go ahead and sort of offset the help to the groundwater that you'd be providing by piping in lake water? And Wisconsin, I don't think, really cared for that line of thinking, saying, listen, we already have precautions in place. But that was part of the debate and I think may continue for a while yet.
Chuck, what's the timeline moving forward now on this request?
Well, again, conference call and in-person meetings. There may be a meeting if on May 10th and 11th, I think those are the dates again, unless they've been changed. I think May 10th and 11th, if the panel is ready to make recommendations by the 11th, they would go off to the governors, and there could either be the governors or their representatives at another meeting in June, and we'll know more. And then we'll see whether there's going to be lawsuits after this. Right now, environmental groups were happy to hear that the water service area around Waukesha might be restricted, but they're holding off on giving their okay, and we don't quite know what all the governors have in mind. Governor Scott Walker in Waukesha last week was raising questions about New York's Governor Cuomo, saying he never leaves the state. We don't know what he's thinking. So, you know, if the hell that's true, then this could go right down to the last minute, or we could know well before that mid-June meeting.
And Chuck, just briefly, we know about Waukesha being out ahead on this one. Are there any other cities waiting in the wings saying, well, if this goes through for Waukesha, we're next?
Well, I think we've heard more about that potentially happening in other states. Examples were mentioned during the discussions, like, well, what if some community in Ohio comes forward? There's various reports that suggest it's not a lot of communities, at least not immediately, but over time there could be more than a few. But again, it's not like every state is going to apply, I don't think, but stay tuned.
Chuck, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Krumbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about the meeting last week to talk about Waukesha's application to divert drinking water from Lake Michigan. Remember, you can follow Chuck's reporting on that issue and a whole lot more over at WPR.org. Just click on the news link and see all the work our reporters are up to right there. If you're looking for a solid prediction about which party is going to win the White House come November, you could look to the usual pundits and politicos, or you could see what the woolly caterpillars of Bodega Bay, California have to say about it.
That's right. The caterpillars have been right the last 30 years, according to two researchers at the University of California, Davis, and that's a pretty decent track record.
Apparently, if the caterpillar populations are more abundant in the month of March, Democrats win. If the numbers are down, Republicans win.
And here's the clincher. So what does it mean this year? Well, the results are fuzzy because for the first time in 30 years, the numbers are a little low. They're not crazy low. Researchers say, though, that their best guess is the caterpillars are leaning to the right, meaning there would be a Republican victory. But the option that seems to make the most sense, given the caterpillar population, is that there could be some kind of third-party conservative candidate.
Now, it could be, you know, this is just coincidence that the caterpillars match up one party or the other.
Right, for 30 years.
For 30 years, yeah. It's only 7 elections.
A 30-year coincidence.
But if they somehow nail it on a third-party independent conservative bid, I'm going to be watching these caterpillars like a hawk, but not eating them like a hawk might, I guess.
Yeah, you don't want to threaten them.
I don't want to menace them. I don't want to skew their views. So keep watching the caterpillars. This is Central Time.